Now, it's time for Playing with Fire with Chef Tom and Stu at the new 104.7 WHLI. Brought to you by Santa Giada Pinot Grigio.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shaudel, and I'm here with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. I survived July 4th, unscathed, kind of, and, you know, we're on to the rest of the summer now.
So. I got to tell you, I'm all conflicted with the capabilities of the weather reporting people. Because they didn't get it right.
Well, they blew Saturday for sure. I had a big barbecue planned for Saturday, and the forecast was 60% chance of rain. And the following day was the rain day, and it was 20% chance. So we decided to play the odds and postpone it. It turned out the Saturday was fine. We could have done it on Saturday. But, you know, you can't really, you know, when you're expecting 1,000 people, you can't really... You know, what am I going to do with them if it rains? I can't, there's no place to house them. You know what I mean? It's just too many people. So we decided to go err on the side of safety and have the barbecue on Sunday. And Sunday turned out to be a stellar day. So it was the right call, you know. But, you know, I don't know if you ever threw a barbecue for 1,000 people, but it's an interesting endeavor, I got to tell you, you know.
No, the only thing I've learned from experience is simplicity. You know, I'm sure yours was pretty elaborate with multiple courses or whatever. But, you know, we actually had a little gathering for the 4th of July, and Carrie was away and she was coming back. She was concerned about getting everything ready. And I said, it's real simple. We're going to do hamburgers and hot dogs and something else, whatever it might be.
Yeah, it's cool.
And we ended up going with, in quotes, barbecue. So I got some brisket,
right,
and we had the hot dogs and hamburgers, and it turned out the brisket was enough with, you know, coleslaw and whatever else.
Yeah, I think you can overthink things sometimes, you know.
Well, that's what I mean. Here I am, you know, in my 65th year.
Look at you. You never look better.
There you go. Thank you. But yes, again, simplicity. Why overthink it? I mean, you know.
You know, that's I'm going to relate this back to food, which is unusual for us because we get off on these tangents sometimes. But, you know, it's when I think of, you know, all of the things that I've done with food over the last 53 years, you know, I always kind of as I've gotten older and a little more settled and mature, hopefully, I realize that sometimes that, you know, you can overthink the ingredients to a dish. You can. You know, I kind of take the Tuscan road sometimes, and what they do in Tuscany is they just use fabulous ingredients and kind of get out of the way, you know, and just let the ingredients sing on their own, you know. And sometimes as chefs, we, you know, in our zeal to reinvent the wheel and come up with something interesting, and, you know, and thank God that we do that because, you know, it sometimes results in some home runs. But other times I think you can almost overthink it and screw it up. You know, you take a gorgeous piece. Like if you look at how the Greeks handle fish, right? The Greeks basically take the fish from the water onto the grill, lemon, olive oil, and sometimes a little oregano, and pretty much that's it. And it's the fish that they're concerned with, not the stuff, you know? And that's kind of cool, you know?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. But, I mean, you can get way too granular with this stuff. I mean, let's just get down to basics. I mean, if you need a roll, I mean, do you go with the 99-cent package rolls? Do you go with the brioche roll? Do you go with the potato roll? And then how do you handle a foot-long hot dog and as compared to a slider? Like, I mean, well, you know, you can go crazy just on simplicity.
Yeah, you can. But I think the thing to do is to just, you know, organize it, you know, in your head, you know, especially if you cook it at home. You know, like if I do a barbecue for 1,000 people, that's a whole other, you know, kind of thing, right? So let's just take the home thing, you know. You basically, you know, just decide on your menu. And yeah, if you want a foot-long hot dog, make sure you have foot-long rolls. Otherwise, you trim each end, you know, when you eat it, you know, just eat the one.
But do you really ever find those?
What?
Foot-long rolls?
I can find them, yeah. But they're generally not around to the, you know, like in Stop and Shop or whatever, you know. So you just, you know, you got a lot of hot dog hanging off the end. It's like, you know,
yeah,
you know, it's not the worst thing in the world. You know, if you're a hot dog guy, I kind of avoid them myself, but they certainly do smell good. I got to tell you, you know, we'll serve them for family meals sometimes at the restaurants or something, you know, to give us, we got to feed the help.
So, you know, again, life is all about taste and opinions. As far as hot dogs, are you the type that likes an all-beef hot dog? Do you want a kosher dog? Do you want ballpark Franks?
Yeah, I kind of like all-beef, and kosher would be good for me only because they pay a little more attention than the average bear with hot dogs. You know, obviously somebody once said that, you know, if you saw how they were made, you'd never eat them. And I said, well, if I thought that way, I'd never be able to look at my brother, you know? So, but, you know, it's kind of like the sausage-making thing. It's a little, you know, ugly, I guess. I don't really eat hot dogs all that much. I have one or two a year, maybe. And, you know, I have this one Salvadorian guy who works for me, and he makes family meal for the people all the time. So every once in a while, if he's, like, busy or bored or whatever, you know, tired, he'll just make a bunch of hot dogs, you know, for the guys. And I tease him. We call it Salvadorian filet mignon, you know. So he makes a Salvadorian filet mignon, and everybody gets it, you know, some with mustard, some with ketchup. You know, it's hilarious to watch people eat, you know, and the preferences. But, yeah, I would prefer personally a kosher dog, you know. All beef is good, too, you know, for me. But, again, I'm not really a good judge because I'm a two-time-a-year guy. But, you know, there's something to be said for the dirty water dogs, right, in the city, you know, in the stands, the kiosks.
When you did the catering up at Jewel, you used to have Wagyu hot dogs or something?
Yeah, we had Wagyu hot dogs, yeah. I mean, that's just kind of a, you know, a, what would I call it?
Is that a perceptual thing, or there really is a difference when you get down to that one?
Well, the Wagyu has a bigger fat content. That's really the only difference, you know. You know, there's levels of Wagyu, too. You have American Wagyu, you have, you know, and then you have the Japanese Wagyu and the A5 Prefecture, and, you know, those things are so expensive. I mean, I bought, 2 years ago, I bought a strip, a New York strip, which is, they're probably about a foot and a half long, you know. That's what they cut the New York steaks out of. And generally, they're about 100, and right now, they're running about $160, $170, something like that. Wagyu is 800, you know, so it's four times the cost of, you know, the regular beef. But you can see the difference. I mean, it's almost white, you know, the fat content's so high. And they give you the whole speech, you know, they give you like a diploma with it, you know, they graduated from Wagyu College or whatever, these cows, you know. And they were sung to at night, and they played Beethoven, you know, in the morning, and, you know, they were massaged and, you know, fed and this, that, and the other thing. So it's really kind of it's an extravagant confection, really. It's the only way I can explain it. And if you've ever had Wagyu, you realize you can't eat much of it because it's so rich. You know, 2 ounces is kind of plenty, but that 2 ounces will cost you $100, you know, whatever. It's just, it's that expensive. I don't really serve it much. There's not a big market for it. You know, I have two or three people that'll order it at the club, but, yeah, that's about it. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, spend $800 to sell, you know, $200 worth of Wagyu. But, you know, we had the hot dogs at Jewel just because it was kind of a thing. I want to do this thing at the bar called the Home Wrecker. And I used to do this Wagyu hot dog, which was wrapped in bacon, and then it was served with like a sirloin and black bean chili. We had fried egg on it. We had avocado, guacamole. We had pico de gallo. It was just kind of a big mishmash on top of this hot dog. And it was, you know, we were selling them for like $15, you know. And they were flying. I mean, we sold a lot of them. It was a lot of fun, you know. Sometimes it's fun to just take, you know, an ingredient like that or a dish like that and kind of screw around with it and make it your own and just kind of have fun with it. It was more like a tongue-in-cheek thing than... Did I ever tell you about the bologna that we did, the bologna sushi?
I vaguely remember you... I think you were away and there was a Newsday story that broke.
No, it was they called me up, Newsday called me up and asked me if I would do... like a tongue-in-cheek thing on bologna sushi for, I don't know, some kind of holiday thing or whatever. I don't remember. But anyway, I said, all right, you know. So I did this. I worked up this whole bologna sushi, you know, kind of role in theory, you know. And I said that, you know, we only use you know, local bologna that's, you know, organically grown and, you know, it's farmed down in Stu Leonard's place behind the thing they graze, you know, the whole thing. Anyway, I went on about this thing, right? And so they publish it Newsday, and I get like 30 reservations for the bologna sushi, right? I'm like, now what? I mean, I thought they knew I was kidding, you know? So we had to come clean. I was talking to Peter Giannotti about this whole thing, you know, because he was the one that orchestrated it, you know? And we were laughing on the phone. I called him. I said, now I got 30 reservations. What am I supposed to do? He said, you got to be kidding me. I said, no, I'm serious, you know? Anyway, so when the people came, we had to inform them, you know, I'll make you a bologna sushi if you want, because you really don't want it, you know? So I had kind of like, it was almost like a spicy tuna roll. We had a spicy bologna roll, I think it was called, or whatever. Anyways, having a little fun, and it blew up, you know?
The bologna with rice, I'm not sure about, but I wonder what the unique pairing would be. I mean, do you do compressed sauerkraut or coleslaw with it or something?
Yeah, well, bologna.
Or maybe you use rye bread or something, and you use that as the bed or something.
I think you're overthinking this, Stu. I think we should probably just scrap the whole idea, you know?
Well said.
Yeah. Anyway, so I've been to a couple of restaurants lately that I really liked. Amano and Allure, I'll tell you the truth. It's like, imagine that. I had a pretty good meal in my own place. It's startling sometimes. You know? But no, all kidding aside, you know where I went to? I went to dinner at Plancha in Garden City. Have you ever been there?
No.
It's the sister restaurant of Salumi in Massapequa.
Oh, you started to talk about that the previous week.
And they do a nice little job there. You know, it's all tapas menu and well done, well thought out. I had a ball there. And their wine list is reasonably priced. You can find great bottles in the $30 range, $35 range, you know. So it's really an interesting little place to go. And he's got this thing down to a science. I mean, you know, the boards are great. You know, he has these cheese and meat boards, which are a lot of fun, you know, especially if you have a group of people, you know, and they have thematic, there's an Italian board with Italian cheeses and, you know, a Spanish board with Spanish cheeses, obviously. So it's really a fun place to eat. And it's a fun place to go with friends because you can share a lot of these small dishes. You know, you can order five or six, seven of the dishes, and they're all kind of interesting, you know. They do a real good job. His wife is the executive chef. I don't see her there cooking, but, you know, she devises all the menus and you know, does the recipes and stuff. And it's really a fun place to go. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, it's probably the most fun way to eat for me is to just have a bunch of appetizers. I don't really order entrees as much as I used to anymore, you know. It's more if I go out, we'll just, you know, have a whole bunch of little dishes, appetizers or whatever. Oysters for sure, you know. And that's another thing. This is the time of year now. You know, oysters are starting to, get really good. I've gotten some really interesting ones from, you know, the Peconic Bay out east. You know, Widow's Hole and, Peconic Golds and stuff. There's just some great oysters coming in now. And you know what we were doing too? I do these raw bars for some of these golf outings and stuff. And so sometimes we'll have, you know, you got to order enough. You don't know how much you're going to eat. So you're always ordering, you know, 10% more than you need. And I've been doing these roasted oysters that have been selling real well. I make a compound butter with
roasted oysters.
Yeah. And it's really easy to do. And you can, it's the butters, you can use your imagination because compound butters are fun. And what I do is I'll take, and if you're at home, you want to write this down, you can do that. But you take like a pound of butter, let's say, you know, and then for this particular recipe, what I do is I take garlic and shallots and I mince them and I saute them up a little bit, right? Just so they get a little bit of color and then cool them down and take like chopped parsley, a little bit of tequila and a little bit of very finely minced prosciutto. And I mix that in a softened butter thing. And then what you can do is you can take that in like a plastic wrap, right? And lay it out in a plastic wrap. And then twist the ends, you know, and keep like swinging it over and over and over again. What'll happen, it'll come into like a hot dog shape, you know, when you twist the ends of it, you know. And then you just put that in the refrigerator and you can use that to melt on a steak or whatever. But I use it in, you know, I'll soften it up a little bit, and I'll put a teaspoonful of each butter in on top of a raw oyster. And then when you roast them, I put them in the oven. You got to kind of put them on like kosher salt or rock salt or whatever to keep them from moving, you know. Because, you know, the round end of the shell, you know, if it falls over, the butter falls out and it kind of defeats the purpose. So if you take some rock salt or kosher salt or whatever and put it in your pan, and you need a little bit of, you know, height to it, maybe a half inch or something, and you sit the oysters in that so they sit flat, and you just roast that in a hot oven like 450 degrees.
And it's half the shell or?
Yeah, half shell. Right? And so you put the butter on top, put it in the oven, and just when the butter melts, you know, the oysters will roast a little bit and cook in the butter. And then at the end, you know, you take them out, you serve them on the rock salt so they're still, you know, kind of, you know, stable.
Do you serve them warm or do
yeah,
you?
Yeah, hot.
Right out of the oven?
Yeah, hot, absolutely. And you know, take a little piece of bread or whatever, if you dip in that butter, it's fabulous, you know. And it's light, you know, it's like Rockefeller is, you know, it's got some cream and cheese and, you know, spinach in it, it's a little heavier. This is a nice light little appetizer to serve if you, you know, you want, if you're raw oyster, you know, phobic a little bit, you know, this is a nice way to eat them, you know, without.
What about on the grill? How do you, or can you?
Yeah, you can, sure. You just put them on hold, and they'll open up, you know, because it gets a little hot in there, you know. And so.
So you don't even have to split the shell. It will pop itself.
It'll pop itself, yeah. Yeah, and then you can just, you know, you can melt that butter and just pour a little on right before it goes out, you know. So, you know, just take the shell off. The problem with that is, you know, you're going to have to take the shell off. And they're hot, you know, so you have to have a glove or something on it.
So when you're doing the roasting or you're putting them on the grill, once they pop open or you've opened it, do you scoop it out? Is that called shucking?
Well, shucking is just, you know, taking the top shell off.
But do you scoop it so it's loose in the shell? Or?
I wouldn't do that because it's going to be hot and you're going to be messing around with it, you know. So I think you can let them scoop it at the table at that point. If you're opening clams or oysters on a half shell, you always detach it from the bottom so you can slurp it, you know, it comes right out. You don't want to be fighting with it with a fork or whatever, you know.
But when you cook it, that's not an issue.
No, not really, because it separates easier, you know.
Gotcha.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but they're fun. I mean, oysters to me are really a, you know, God's gift to seafood. I mean, I love them. And the interesting part about oysters that and a lot of people who don't eat them often don't know this. They're really different, you know. I mean, flavor wise, you know, clams are always the same. You open a clam, clam's a clam. You know, whether it comes from here, New Bedford, whatever. Oysters are different because, I guess it's because of what they eat or whatever. You know, they're kind of filters. And you know, the ones that I have from, I have some Peconic Golds and I have some that come from the mouth of the Connecticut River up in, I guess it's, where's the ferry going? New London. And she plants them up there. She has some beds up there. And they taste completely different. And they taste completely different from the ones in the Sound that I get in Bayville and some of the ones in the Peconic Bay down here. I have my own grown called Merle Pearls. And they're grown specifically for me in the Great South Bay here, east of here, obviously. But they all have different flavors. And you know, you can get, like, the ones from New Bedford, Massachusetts, Maine, Nova Scotia. And they all have these nuanced flavors. And it's so interesting to take, you know, there are Crate and Barrel, not Crate and Barrel, what is it? What's the place in Bayshore?
Cracker Barrel?
No. The place in Bayshore is an oyster bar. I'll think of it anyway. But if you go to a place like that, you know, a lot of times they'll offer oyster tastings, you know, where you have like three of this, three of that, three of the other, and you have a dozen and three of each or four of each, whatever. And it's just, it's interesting to me to
what kinda, town is that in?
It's in Bayshore. It's Oyster Bar in Bayshore. And it's got two names. It's something and something. I can't remember it. But fabulous way. It's almost like, you know, wine by the glass.
It's the salt and barrel.
Salt and barrel, that's it. I call it Crate and Barrel. I always get mixed up, you know. But anyway, yeah, it's just a fun way to check them out. And, you know, I've been to Salt and Barrel, and they do a great job there.
So now here, now I'm not confused but intrigued. So you're saying there's nuances in taste and
yes.
from where they're harvested or whatever mm-hmm. or farmed. But now probably most people – put something on their oyster when they eat it.
Yes.
How do you, again, never noticed.
Minuet?
Minuet, which
minuet.
Is like
no,
a.
No, minuet's a dance. Minuet's a sauce.
Minuet, which yeah. is like
no,
a.
Minuet. Minuet.
Minuet.
There you go.
Which is like a vinegar and onion.
Vinegar and pepper and shallot, yeah. You know, I'm not a big fan of that, I especially because I like oysters and wine. There's certain wines that match really well with oysters. How do I say this? There's the cocktail sauce people.
Right, well, that's what I'm getting. All these things mask.
They do.
The taste. And a lot of times when we talk about seafood, we talk about shrimp. And you always say shrimp is that which is bland.
Well, shrimp's so an excuse to eat ketchup. You know?
Right. So with that, yes. But now when you're talking about the oysters, and I'm at a raw bar tasting, should I go like naked?
Yeah. Well, I would put clothes on before I go, but you know, because you're going to create quite a stir, but not that I've seen you naked, but just based on experience. Yeah. You have to have a shirt with a collar, you know? But I think that, yeah, I mean, I'm a naked lemon and sometimes a little horseradish guy if I want a little kick. I don't use cocktail sauce. I don't use mignonette. And I don't serve
and
mignonette.
And why lemon?
I think lemon, it's just the acidity that brings out the brightness in some of it, you know. But, yeah, if you really want to find out what they taste like, just go naked, you know. And don't tell them I sent you. But The flavor differences between the things are startling sometimes, you know? I mean, and some of them have this coppery quality. It's hard to describe, but yeah. And, you know, the mignonette to me is, you know, it's red wine vinegar, generally speaking, red wine vinegar, cracked black pepper, and diced shallot or minced shallot. And I guess it's okay, but if you're drinking wine, vinegar is not the flavor you want, you know, on your palate. So when I do mignonettes, I do them differently. I do a cucumber mignonette with verjus. And verjus is unfermented grape juice. And it can be anything from bone dry, kind of like you would think sour, to sweet, you know. And I use one that's a little sweeter. Then if you had the scale in the middle, I'd be a little bit to the sweeter side than the sour side. And I find that with the cucumber juice, and the shallot and the pepper and the verjus, it's a much milder thing, and you can have wine with that, with the oyster, without going, you know. Oh,
and the cucumber
God.
Juice, is that like pureed, or you just?
Yeah, I do it. I buzz it in a blender. I peel the cucumbers, you know, and I take the seeds out. I take the cucumber meat, so to speak, and buzz it down in a blender. At high speeds until it liquefies.
That's interesting because, I mean, I guess when people describe cucumber, it's very fresh. It's very light. It's
well, yeah, and I think that's
refreshing.
What, you know, for me, that's what I would want on my oysters, you know. I don't want anything like, you know, like I said, I'll use a little bit. Sometimes I'll use even a little bit, of, like a drop or two of hot sauce if I'm just looking for a kick, or a little bit of horseradish. But I taste them first before, you know. Years ago, I read somewhere that the interview process for IBM included a lunch, and they would look to see whether you salted your food before you tasted it or after you tasted it. And that would show like a lack of judgment or something, you know? And it makes sense. I mean, you know, some people, you know, you put some food down in front of them, they just immediately grab the salt shaker. You don't see it as much now as you did years ago. But they would immediately grab the salt shaker and a pepper shaker and just, you know, go crazy, right, without finding out. That's a bad idea in restaurants because we're supposed to salt the food to the point where you don't need that. Now, some people have more salt tolerance than others, you know, so there's always that, you know, guy that's going to grab it. But the bottom line is, you know, with the oysters, I would taste one and then make my decision about what I'm going to use on it, if anything. You know, maybe that would go with a little bit of lemon. Maybe that, you know, a little bit of horseradish should be fun with that. Or maybe just a drop of hot sauce, you know, not to the point where you're going to run out of the building screaming, you know, because you don't want to screw your palate up. But I always taste them first and then make the decision later. And that's just me. I'm an oyster freak. So, you know, I do freaky things with them. But, you know, if you need cocktail sauce, get it, you know. But I think that's, we tend to do that. We tend to mask things, you know, that are pure. I mean, you know, shrimp. I mean, shrimp is one of those things that doesn't have a lot of flavor. So there's garlic, there's cocktail sauce, there's, you know, butter and lemon, this, that, and the other thing to help it along. And it's all fine. But know what you're doing first. You know, taste the shrimp first and then, you know, figure it out later. You know?
So that leads to a quick question for you. One of our listeners, a longtime listener, Ron Boning, says he's now growing garlic in his garden.
Really?
Yes.
Good for him.
And so he's looking for some insight on how to use it, as well as what to do with the garlic scapes.
Well, garlic scapes are fun. I mean, you know, you can saute those and put them over anything. I like them over steak.
Now, there might be some listeners that want to know what a garlic scape is.
Yeah, well, it's that shoot that comes out, you know, of the garlic. And it looks like a scallion with a little flour on the top. And basically, I just take them in a very hot pan with a little bit of either extra virgin olive oil or butter, you know, saute them quickly. And I like to drape them over steaks because I think that, you know, if you take a little garlic scape and you put it on your steak, it kind of enhances that. You know, you
get plus, it probably looks good.
It does. Chicken, too. You know, it goes good with chicken. You know, I've seen them in pastas. I've seen them, you know, used in a lot of different ways. I kind of like them with meat, though. You know, I think it adds a subtle flavor without, you know, garlic's kind of a tricky thing. You know, if you over-garlic something, it's like, you know, we've all had that bad Italian meal where there was so much garlic in it, you couldn't eat it, you know.
Don't some places serve like a roasted garlic, like with your bread?
Yeah, you can do that. That's, you know, that takes the sting out of it, too. You know, the garlic when it's raw is terrible. I mean, it's hot. It's, ugh, you know, it needs to be cooked. And most of the times, I find that if you puree it, you know, and you have this like chopped garlic thing. I mean, they even sell them in stores where it comes in a little bit of oil. I don't like to use it that way because you can tend to over garlic things like that. I like it sliced, you know, very thinly. Mm. So if you don't like it, you see in the dish, you can pull it out if you're garlic phobic. And if you love it, you know, it's great to have a little.
So when you get the minced garlic at the store, that's in a, like an oil base, you're saying?
Yeah.
So you mentioned shrimp not being all that tasty or having a its own characteristic taste. So my mind starts wandering, and I remember one of the foods that we served for our barbecue gathering the other day was tacos.
Right.
So we, I guess we browned some chopped meat,
right,
and used the, you know, the taco powder that comes in the package.
Shame on you.
And then Carrie also made some shrimp. So she boiled up some shrimp, and they were plain. But if you were doing a taco bar or a taco salad or whatever, how would you have offered up the shrimp for the taco?
Well, funny you should ask. There's a dish that I do that sells like crazy, and it's a blackened shrimp taco. And so what I do is I make blackening season, for lack of a better term. That's what they call it. And that's a mixture of paprika and black pepper and chili powder.
So this is in the guise of like Cajun?
Yeah. It was made popular by Paul Prudhomme, who's passed on. He was a chef down in New Orleans. He had a restaurant called K. Paul's. His wife's name was Kay, and his name was Paul, obviously. So it was K. Paul's. And it was kind of a joint, you know. It wasn't really this high-end restaurant. And he used to do this black and redfish thing, you know. And redfish was, you know, it's a Louisiana native fish. And, you know, he put it in his seasoning and put it in this really hot cast iron pan. And it became all the rage of the 80s, you know. He caught fire for some reason. I don't know if he had a PR agent or whatever. But it became this thing, you know. And he actually opened up a Cajun restaurant in New York. And it didn't really work out for him. It's certain cuisines don't travel out of their zone, you know. It's great when you're there, you know, but it's like barbecue. I mean, for, you know, 8 million people live in Manhattan, there's 5 barbecue places, you know what I mean? There's probably 5 barbecue places in Athens, Georgia, you know, on every block, you know what I mean? So when you're in the South and there's this romance about, you know, or New Orleans, there's romance about the food of the place, you know? And anyway, so he caught fire and this blackening season, everybody has their own little take on it. So mine, I use paprika, I use a lot of black pepper, I use some cayenne. Right. I use fresh thyme, salt, and chili powder. That's pretty much what I use. And so, I would dip the shrimp in this blackening powder and then saute it in a pan. And then when I make my tacos, you know, I make my own. We make our own tortillas there. But you can buy them. And I think people, when they serve tacos, they're too big. I use the little, my tacos aren't more than 4 inches around. And you can have 2, 3, 6, 12, whatever you want, you know. But I use a little bit of guacamole on the bottom. And I place the shrimp in the guacamole. And then I'll use a pico de gallo, which is a tomato salsa, right? Fresh tomato salsa. And then some chipotle aioli, which is mayonnaise that's been seasoned with vinegar and chipotles. And chipotles are basically smoked jalapenos. They come in adobo sauce. And then I use a little micro cilantro on the top as a garnish. Now, that being said, here we go. You know, there's your mother taco, so to speak, right? And now we have variations on a theme. So you can use, I think they sell coconut shrimp or something. You can fry up some coconut shrimp, put that in there. I would change the salsa. And for coconut shrimp, I get this island feel in my head. So I would use maybe a pineapple salsa or a mango salsa or something along those lines. And, hip it up a little bit. You can use meat, beef. A lot of people use chopped meat. I do a different thing. I take, regular beef, like ends from the sirloin, and I'll cook it down with cumin and onion and stuff like that and use that. But let's take a little break quickly, and we'll sell some advertising and we'll come back and I'll wax poetically about tacos.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Giada Pinot Grigio, a wine produced by a family of German-speaking Italians from Alto Adige. This region is home to another famous Santa Pinot Grigio, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle, just added quality. Pick up your bottle of Santa Giada Pinot Grigio at Stu Leonard's Wine in Farmingdale and Ryan's Wine in East Meadow. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me at chad@savorian.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Yeah, so we were talking about tacos, and one of my favorite vehicles for food is tacos, and they're great. They're great as an entree. They're great as a leftover thing, as a vehicle to get. We call it getting rid of something, but, to use up leftovers or something like that. And you can really, the great part about tacos is that, you can use anything to make them. I mean, I advise making your own tacos. It's a fun process. It doesn't take a lot of time and effort. You buy the masa and you just mix it with water and make little balls. You get a little taco press. Line it with plastic so they don't stick, and you're good to go. And then you just kind of, warming them on the grill or you're on a flat top or something like that. But it makes a big difference in the flavor. And then, again, there's a lot of different things you can do. But I love to take chicken thighs, boneless chicken thighs, which are fairly inexpensive, and I cook them down with sautéed onion, a little bit of garlic, and tomato juice. And, jalapenos or some kind of a pepper, chipotle peppers or whatever, to give it a little tang. They call it chicken tinga in Mexico. And you don't want it like watery. You want to cook that down until it almost becomes like a little bit of a, like a wet paste, And you use that in a taco with, some kind of a tomato sauce is good I've even used banana salsas, actually, in tacos, which is
really?
Fruit salsas. Yeah, I mean, because, mango and pineapple are, all the rage. Orange, I've used orange. So it's kind of something that, you're only, constricted by your imagination. And like I said, it's a great way to use up leftovers. If you have leftover lamb or leftover any kind of chicken or whatever, you put them in there with some guacamole and, and you can make some fun sauces with them, too, like, all the chili sauces, like the salsa verde, they call it, which is a real hot one, or like a salsa roja, which is made with a different type of basil chili or whatever. They're a lot of fun to experiment with. And I won't tell you how to make them here because it'll take too long. But, there are all kinds of recipes on the Internet for those little sauces. And you can do them in small quantities. I make them in large quantities, obviously, but... it's sort of fun to experiment, how much heat you can take or, how much heat, you really like, to do the different sauces on top of these tacos. And, it's just a fun way to eat. I know my daughter does, you know, Taco Tuesday for the kids sometimes. You know, she'll just make a bunch of tacos. And it's just a hoot. You know, you go there, grab one, two, three, whatever. You got different ingredients. You can make your own, you know. A lot of fun. And it's fun to make with the kids. You know, I mean, I've had my granddaughter, you know, with the taco press, and they just get a kick out of it. You know, make two or three, and they get bored and go in the living room and watch a movie, you know. But it's just a fun process to let them know that, you know, not everything comes from the store shelves, you know. There's things that you can actually make. You can make pasta.
Pretty interesting. It's funny, but I guess sometimes people get a little crazy. Over the weekend, Carrie's daughter went out with a bunch of her friends, and they went to a local pizzeria, and she goes, "We had a Nutella pizza."
Oh, yeah. I hope for dessert.
and well, I'm really confused, because then the supposedly the order taker said, "Do you want cheese on that?" Which really threw me for a yeah, because I would think that needs to be, I don't even know if this is right, but like more like a cream cheese. I mean, like cheesecake type of cheese.
Yeah.
Rather than like mozzarella
cheese. Is sweetened too, you know?
Yeah. So, but I didn't get, because I mean, some people will make a Nutella crepe.
Yeah.
That I understand.
For those who don't know, Nutella is like a chocolate hazelnut paste.
Right,
you
right.
Know? Yeah.
But I don't see that on pizza dough.
Well, no, I've seen it as a dessert pizza. Which, it's not for me personally, but I get that, you know, that's fine. You know, you want to do that with some cherries on top or whatever, serve it as a dessert. All right, yeah, I'm okay with that. But, you know, Parmesan, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, well, they had it just with the Nutella. So you're saying that it wasn't so crazy. Okay.
No, I mean, I've seen Nutella pizzas as served as dessert. You know, I've seen chocolate linguine served as dessert, you know. Like I said, it's not for me personally, but... You know, I could, yeah, why not? You know, I actually made a chocolate fettuccine once for a guy who insisted on having it, you know, at a party, right? So it was his chocolate fettuccine, and we did almost like a creme anglaise sauce with it, you know, and I think there might have been some raisins in there or something. I don't remember, but, and some nuts. So, but it was served as dessert, you know, it was kind of like a novelty thing, you know? You know, why not? You know, I mean, as long as the pizza crust is thin, you know, if you have a thickened crust with a Nutella, I don't know, it wouldn't be for me. I wouldn't do a Sicilian Nutella, you know. But, you know, I'm a purist when it comes to pizza, to a degree. I mean, I like different ingredients, but, you know, when you start putting ham and pineapples on it, I don't know. I'm out on that, you know. I think that, you know, there are much better toppings for pizza than pineapples, ham, and Nutella, you know. So.
Well, what's the Asian noodles with like a peanut sauce on it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, some use soba noodles, some use regular, I can't think of the name of it right now, ramen noodle, whatever, you know. Yeah, you know, that you know, every cuisine has its pasta. You know, pasta started in China and somehow got to Italy a couple hundred years later. So there's always, you know, there's in almost every cuisine, there's a pasta. I mean, you look at, you know, ravioli in Italy, and then you go to Poland, and they have, you know, what is it, Stu? The Polish dumplings,
the pierogies.
Pierogies, yeah, there you go. And so it's the same thing, you know. It's pasta dough. I mean, they do dumplings in China and in Asia. You know, they have shrimp dumplings and vegetable dumplings. It's all good, you know. All pasta, you know. and it's funny how they each treat it, you know. But you know, why do they use peanut sauce in Asian around them, you know? Because they grow peanuts there. You know what I mean? People using what's around them, you know? Why tomatoes in southern Italy? Well, they grow tomatoes there. You don't see much tomato in northern Italy. You know, there's not a lot of tomato sauces up there. It's different. It's cheese up there, you know? It's like they make Parmesan and, you know, Pecorino and stuff like that. So I think it all starts with what we have around us, and then, you know, now it's different because we have air travel and, you know, all kinds of things. But when all this stuff started, it was based on local ingredients because that's what people had at the ready. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, you know, 150 years ago, nobody was flying to or flying prawns in from Hawaii to Italy. You know, it just didn't happen. So you used what was there, what the fishermen caught, what the farmers grew and ranchers, you know, grew, cattle, chickens, whatever. And that's the story, you know. We're kind of getting back to that a little bit, which is kind of cool, you know, with this local thing, you know. And, you know, I try and stay as local as I can for myriad reasons, but the two basic ones are I want to support the people that are, you know, here, and hopefully they'll support me. You know, it's a one hand washes the other thing. And for the fact that it's good, it's, you know, I'm not this windmill-hugging environmentalist, but, you know, you're kind of concerned about it, right? I don't want to see, you know, transportation costs and all this other stuff that goes along with bringing things in from Florida or whatever. So, you know, it's less gas burn, and I guess that's good news. And so it's nice to, you know, stay local if you can. I mean, you know, there are certain realities, like I said, and I always say, you know, I can't be completely local in the winter because I'd have 11 menu items with cauliflower on it. You know, there's not a lot of, you know, tomatoes being grown out here in the winter or corn or whatever. So, you know, we do stray out in the off season. But right now, I mean, if you go out east, the farm stands are starting to bloom. You know, you'll see a lot of local stuff coming to market now. In July, tomatoes will start to come in, corn. I was out there 2 days ago, and all of a sudden I see the corn stalks are higher than they were, you know. So it's coming, you know.
So when you were out east, I was at a really interesting event the other night, and I guess it would be really cool next year actually to hook up with you and go, unless you were there and I didn't know it, which is the Long Island Hospitality Ball.
I wouldn't do that if you paid me. That is just craziness. Thousands of people. It's more of a bar thing. You know, I'm more of a food thing, you know, guy. I did one out east. I did the Great Chefs of the North Fork or whatever they call it. Anyway, it was like six of us, you know, doing six different courses. And it was just...
Well, I was saying to go as a guest, but, and because you would know everybody there, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's an industry-centric sure. event for the hospitality and restaurant and
whatever,
bar trade
at
Crest Hollow.
Crest Hollow,
and
yeah.
All the liquor purveyors and wine purveyors are there for sampling, and the restaurants are there. I always laugh because I'm usually there early, and when you go for the food samplings, they'll load your plate up, and I go, rookies.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's probably 1,000 people come to this event.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And, you know, if they're serving, you know, regular-sized meatballs, well, they're in error.
Yeah. I did it once, and once was enough for me.
There you go. But I was curious. I met somebody out from out east that had an interesting product. I guess it's a bar. It's Lynn's Hula Hut, but they have come up with infused spirits. I believe they're vodkas, but they're...
The Hula Hut, is that in Montauk?
Yeah. And I was talking about you because, you know, when you talk about, and I'm not playing up to you, when you talk about Long Island-centric people, there's none other than you when it comes to, you know, talking about, you know, the produce and fishing.
Sure.
So you definitely are somebody Long Island-centric, and it seems like everybody knows you. If you mention Tom Shodell, oh, yeah, I know my brother worked with him, yeah, this yeah, or that or the other.
Well, I've been around a long time. You know, I'm getting old, man. I'm, you know, and the funny part is, you know, I talked to a friend of mine. He says, you know, you're going to retire. I'm like, I don't know. I retire now. Maybe I get 10 years. You know, I retire when I'm died. You know, I'll have a lot more time. But I still, you know, after all these years and – like I said, I'm going into, I guess, my 54th year now in the restaurant business. I still like it, you know. There's something about it. There's something, you know, it bit me when I was 15 years old, and I never looked back. And it's just been, for the most part, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's been ups and downs for sure. But it's been pretty much a joy. It's, I don't mind working 12 hours a day at this advanced age of mine, you know. And... You know, I'm staring 70 in the puss. I mean, I'll be 70 years old next year. And I don't know. It's just always been a source of joy for me. I mean, I get up in the morning. I look forward to going to work. I look forward to the fish guy coming. What's he bringing me today? You know, how are the vegetables looking? Oh, my God, send the corn back. It sucks, you know. Or holy Moses, look at this thing. It's beautiful, you know. I just enjoy that whole process. There's parts of it that you know, like dealing with employees and dealing with the government and all that stuff, it's a nightmare, you know? And it's why my hair's gray. But the bottom line is the rest of it, just pure cooking, you can't have more fun than that for me anyway.
Well, this will be a great segue into talking about what you started talking about when we began the show today, which is about your properties out east, Amano and Allure.
Yeah.
But just to go through this, I guess I met Lynn Calvo at the hospitality ball, and I just read a little quick thing. Inspired by the well-traveled Calvo's love of tropical places and combining her passions for cocktails and entertaining, Lulu's Hut became a spot on your summer drinking bucket list, they say. So the bar in the Montauk Marine Basin is chic without being pretentious, sophisticated without being stuffy, the type of place you want to grab a drink and catch up with a friend, take a significant other, or even your visiting parents. And the Hula Hut started 6 years ago as in the back of her pickup truck, and before it became a permanent
address. Brick and mortar.
But again, I guess they have this whole line of infused vodkas that they're trying to take national.
Yeah.
But again, as walking around and meeting with all these different people, there are a lot of the restaurateurs all talk about being a part of our show, and we'll see if it really happens. Another intriguing one was Lamani, really known for its Mediterranean cuisine, Greek cuisine. Maybe two or three locations at this point. I know there's one in the city. There's one out here in Manhasset.
Open in Comac, aren't they?
I forget where the other one is.
I'm pretty sure it's Comac. Yeah.
But they're going in a different direction. I believe they're opening an Italian restaurant.
Really?
Which should be opening soon.
Well, there's an eye on the end, you know.
So. Yeah, there you go. So more details to follow. But why don't you share with us what was so exciting about, or what can be exciting about Amano and Allure for our listeners that are going out to the North Fork?
Okay, I don't do enough self-promotion, so here's a shameless plug, right? Amano, to me, is kind of a fun place. If you're into Italian food, I think we do it pretty well. Now, I wanted to go in a direction where it was completely like Italy, you know? And I mean that only in the sense that I didn't want to do, you know, veal parmesan. I didn't want to do all the usual suspects. I wanted to cook like I know they cook in Italy. I've done extensive travel there. I've eaten in 1,000 restaurants in Italy. I think I know the cuisine pretty well. And my partner kind of put a leash on me a little bit. And he said, you know, we got to have some things on the menu that, you know, people can cop to if they, you know, if they're not foodies or whatever. So we did that. There's a chicken parmesan on there and it sells like crazy. There's some meatballs on there, which I think are fun to make. So I don't mind that. But so we do have a couple of things that are, you know, sort of in the sweet spot there for, you know, people who like Italian restaurants. On the other hand, we have things like I make a carbonara out there, but I make it with smoked duck and it's eggless. So it's a little bit different. You know, we do a homemade spicy veal sausage. And we do a Sunday sauce out there too, which is kind of fun, you know.
Really?
Sausage and meatballs or whatever. But there's always interesting specials and, you know, there's wood-fired pizzas, you know, and the pizzas don't have pineapples on it. And it's, you know, we do a goat cheese pizza with local goat cheese out there and, you know, things like that. So it's a fun place to eat. It's, you know, casual. There's a deck in the front. You know, if you want to eat outside, you can do that. And Allure, on the other hand, Allure is, kind of seafood-centric because we're sitting right on the Peconic Bay. And you won't find a prettier sight out there. I mean, you know, I have a huge deck. And it probably seats 150 people on a deck outside. And, you know, to sit there like on a beautiful day looking at the bay, you know, eating lobster in the rough. I did a thing on the menu where I said I wouldn't serve lobster any other way but steamed. I don't want to broil them. I think it dries them out. I don't want to stuff them. I think it takes away from the lobster. You know, if you want to have it, there's places to go. I just think a steamed 2-pound lobster, 1.5, 3/4-pound lobster, while you're sitting there looking at boats bobbing on the water on a gorgeous day with a blue sky and clouds, you know, with butter dripping off your chin and lemon juice coming off your elbows, is just the perfect day. I think it's fabulous, you know. And if you don't want to do that, you can have a lobster roll, which is much neater, you know what I mean? It scratches the same itch, you know. And we do local, a lot of local fish out there. Black sea bass. We do skate. We do fluke. You know, Jeff the chef, who is my partner out there and takes care of it.
I think that rhymes.
Yeah. Jeff Ugal is his name. He's a Filipino, actually, by descent. And a very talented guy, hard worker, and he does a great job out there. And we do a lot of volume. I mean, it's hard to do, you know, it's easy to cook for three people. It's a little harder to cook for 1,000, you know, and we'll do 2,500 people on a weekend, you know, which is crazy, right? So he does a good job out there, and I think it's a great, if you're a seafood person, you know, we do have steaks if you have to, but if you're a seafood person, I think that's the place on the North Fork to go. You know, I think we do it pretty well, and yeah, there are mishaps occasionally, but that happens. It's just a fun place, and it's more, you know, I didn't want to do it when the Allure thing was presented to me. I was like up to here with restaurants. I said, yeah, I got enough. I didn't have people. I don't want to do another one, you know. And I had the keys in my pocket, right? And I was going to go give them back to the landlord because he gave them to me to look at the place, whatever. He says, oh, let me just say, I just want one more look. It's the middle of February, snow on the ground, the whole thing. So I go out there, right? And there's these, you know, the picture windows overlook the bay, right? So I'm looking at the bay. And it just turned me into a valley girl. I'm like, all right, you know, I mean, I'll do it, you know. And it was the view that got me. I said, how many other people are going to get a chance to do this kind of thing, to have this kind of restaurant with the view that we have? And it was just beautiful. I couldn't say no. So I did it, you know. And we'll see. I mean.
And Allure stays open till what part of the year?
We usually close down around the end of October. Sometimes we go to Thanksgiving, depending on what's going on out there. But, you know, last year we stayed open a little later because a lot of people out there didn't want to be.
And what is
the
regular? Is it open 7 days a week?
Yeah, 7 days right now.
And lunch and dinner?
Lunch and dinner, yeah. Cool. Yeah, it's a busy place. I mean, you know, like I said, we can do, you know, 600-700 people, you know, each day on the weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
So many of our listeners always ask about where you frequent. Is it likely that you might be at Allure, you know, throughout the summer, or it you're just all over the place?
I'm all over the place. I'm usually there in the beginning of the week more than the weekends at this point. And it's funny because, you know, people always ask me, well, who cooks when you're not at the restaurant? I said, the same people who cook when I am. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, they think I'm doing every dish. It's very
well,
funny.
Well, as I learned from the open kitchen at Jewel in its day, Tom is like the conductor.
Leonard Bernstein.
He's out in front of the stove rather than behind the stove.
Well, it's more coordination at this point. I mean, you know, I still do stove stuff. But bottom line is, you know, it's like I want the younger kids to do it, you know, because I've done it for 50 years. It's like enough already. You know?
So does Allure have a bar? At Jewel, you had that common table, which was a cool thing.
Yeah. We don't have that. I do have a bar. It's a fairly big bar. And I have an outside bar, too. So there's two bars there. You know, it's a fun place to hang. I mean, you can go there. You can look at the water. You can sit outside. You can, don't have to have an entree. You can have an appetizer. Or just have drinks, whatever you want. You know,
do you have a decent wine by the glass selection?
Oh yeah, totally. You know me. I mean, I'm a wino. So, yeah, there's probably 12 wines by the glass in both places, in Amano and Allure. You know, Amano tends to be a little more Italian bent. You know, I had a list that was half Italian, half Long Island. That's what I did when I opened Allure. I wanted to support the locals, but it was an Italian restaurant, so we wanted to do that. Now, when I opened Allure, originally we had an all-Long Island list, which was a little bit dicey, you know, in the beginning, because people were like, why can't I get a French, you know, whatever, California. And I just decided to make the stand and go with it. And we actually got a Wine Spectator Award for it because it was unique in that regard. I've since softened my stance, you know. I've been beaten into submission, so we do have some non-Long Island wines there. But it's still probably, you know, since I closed Jewel and, you know, sold it, it's probably the most extensive Long Island wine list on Long Island at this point. Jewel had that title for, you know, the years that I was there because we had 130 Long Island wines on the list, which is fairly ambitious, you know. And Long Island's making enough good wine and enough varietals where you can do an all-Long Island list now, which is great, you know. But some people felt it was a little bit, you know, restrictive, I guess. And there's still some of that, you know, mentality, oh, Long Island wine sucks, you know, kind of thing, which isn't true. You know, it only shows the ignorance of the person spouting that, you know. So, I don't know.
So somebody going out to visit a Lure or a Mono, and they know that there's a well-defined wine list, but they need some help. Would your the average server at these locations be able to help somebody navigate through a choice of wine?
Yeah, yeah. Most of them are pretty well trained. I mean, you know, we get some summer help, you know, now this time of year. You know, you just, you're throwing bodies at the problem, you know, and some of them won't be able to, you know, help you out, but they'll always call a manager or somebody who can, you know. So it worst comes to worst, the managers are pretty trained, you know, and pretty well-versed in what's going on with the wines out there. But, you know, the thing is, too, you know, it's a great day to just go out there, hit a winery or two, and then come to one of the restaurants. But even if it's not mine, you know, go to somebody else's. I mean, you know, I was with Noah Schwartz, who's a friend of the show and a talented chef. And, he, you know, he's got Noah's in Greenport. And now he just opened up a restaurant at Chequid Inn on Shelter Island. And, you know, we did that Chefs of the North Fork thing together. And I hadn't seen him in a while. It was good to see him. Great guy, talented chef, nice man. You know, go to his place. Or Stephen Bogardis, he's over in Sunset Inn, Soundview Inn. You know, he's a talented guy. You know, there's good restaurants out there, you know.
The event that you were just talking about, was that a Schnepps event or?
No, it was this guy, Don Evans. He gets, I don't know what his deal is because he does all these events. You know, Rosé Soiree, I think, is a Schnepps event, if I'm not mistaken. But he somehow gets involved in all this, and he gets me involved, and it's annoying sometimes because it's like he begs me to do these things. And this thing wasn't a disaster, but it wasn't well thought out. I mean, they had a lot of people, 300 people, you know, in the aquarium out there. And the kitchen facility, you know, they're still trying to do lunch and dinner, and we're trying to get set up. And it was just a little bit of a scramble, I'll call it.
So on a more enjoyable subject, are there any tasting meals coming up at, or wine pairings at Allure or Amano, or are they usually only at Amano?
Yeah, they're usually only at Amano because it lends itself to it better, and it's usually in the spring and the fall. This is summer, we're too busy to really do that, you know. But, you know, we do those as come-ons when it starts to slow down a little bit, you know. So it's more of a merchandising thing. But, yeah, there'll be some in the fall, you know. And I like to do them with Long Island wineries, you know.
It's interesting. I have some close friends that are very much into wine, and they love when I have some knowledge, but they become big fans of McCall's, and we've been out to Amano for a McCall's wine dinner.
Yeah.
But there was just recently one in the city that they went to, and they had a great time. And it's, again, thanks to you for their insight about the vineyard and again, getting well acquainted with it.
My dish at Chefs of the North Fork was paired with McCall Pinot Noir, which is kind of fun. Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, that's about it. Maybe we're going to close the show here with Tom's Three Keys to Life, which are, as usual, life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last. And keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And we'll see you next week.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Giada Pinot Grigio, a wine produced by a family of German-speaking Italians from Alto Alige. This region is home to another famous Santa, Pinot Grigio, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle, just added quality. Pick up your bottle of Santa Giada Pinot Grigio at Stu Leonard's Wine in Farmingdale and Ryan's Wine in East Meadow. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me at chad@savorian.com.
Sweet Fancy Long Island is the award-winning dessert and pastry company that has become one of the hottest sources for bakery treats available for delivery on Long Island. Each mouth-watering creation has a personality all its own, teasing the palate with its rich flavors, complex textures, and eye-catching presentations. All items at Sweet Fancy Long Island are made 100% from scratch using the highest quality ingredients: Belgian chocolate, European butter, vanilla beans from Tahiti, and the richest, most flavorful fruits available. Their clients can can enjoy any one of our delectable confections from one-of-a-kind pastries, specialty and occasion cakes, French macarons, and karma cups. Their signature line includes an assortment of charming personalized sized desserts served in miniature mason jars. The Sweet Fancy Long Island team takes great pride in presenting a unique, delicious, and elegant dessert experience and works closely with every client to create a memorable dessert that will add an exciting dimension to any celebration. Presently, the work of Sweet Fancy Long Island have been found in some of the area's top restaurants, country clubs, gourmet shops, catering facilities, and Food Network. Go to sweetfancyli.com to order online or to view their incredible gallery of desserts.